Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by entrepreneur and manufacturer Dan Brown, Dan Swinney of the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council, and innovation expert Tom Kuzmierski from the Kellogg Graduate School of Business. Our program tonight coming to you from the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, as you all know by now, Senate Democrats last night, they voted to bring the debate and bring to the floor resolution to the health care situation in the country, at least as they see it. That has been a dominant story throughout the day. It will continue to unfold in the week ahead. The Democrats used all 60 votes to push what they think is an improvement to the health care system, to the American people. There'll be a little more debate, actually probably a lot more debate on it. We'll talk more about that next week on this program. But tonight, we're going to be talking about what I think most polls suggest really is America's biggest problem. It's the health care to some, but to most, it's the economy. It's about jobs. It's about putting people to work. And specifically tonight, for the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking about the manufacturing sector in the United States and what can be done, really, to improve things. And we begin by looking at some of the October manufacturing news that it was just recently released. U.S. manufacturing expanded for a third consecutive month in October. It was the highest growth rate since April of 2006, suggesting that factories are starting to add jobs and fourth quarter gains this year might be on the way. 28 states added jobs. The growth was most significant in education, health care, and the government sectors. Little evidence, however, of good news in the hardest hit industries. The unemployment rates rose in 29 states. Michigan leads the nation in unemployment at 15.1%, followed by Nevada at 13%, Rhode Island 12.9%, California 12.5%, and South Carolina at 12.1%. And tonight, we have people who know a great deal about this subject, and I'd like to begin by talking to Dan Swinney, who's been a guest on this program many times, Executive Director of the Center for Labor and Community Research, a machinist background, comes from the labor movement. But my question to you, Dan, at the moment is, when we're looking at these numbers, what is the hope? What is the hope, if anything, that you see in these numbers and everything else you know about what's going on? And is there hope?
Well, I think there is hope. I think, you know, last fall, last October, I think we saw sort of the culminating sort of events of 30 years of short-term speculative, leadership in our economy. You know, it was in housing markets. It was in manufacturing. Now we have a crisis and we see how that plays itself out. And now you have a country, both nationally and locally, and large companies and small companies and the federal government looking to rebuild our productive sector, our manufacturing sector. Because I think people realize that if we're going to have a middle class in this country, it has to be based on advanced manufacturing. We have a competitive advantage, and we need to build it, and that's what's happening.
Dan Brown also joins us. Dan, you are a designer, an inventor, an entrepreneur, a businessman, a professor. You do a lot.
Yes, sir.
What's your answer to the same question?
Well, I think it's – I agree. How could you not agree with that? But I see it being in the marketplace and competing in a market that sees a lot of foreign competition, and that it's got to be a market-based solution. And the risk-reward scenario for people making those investments to create jobs has to be in a context such that you can take that risk with a realistic chance of getting a reward. And we've lost that dynamic in our economy, I believe.
Tom Kuzmarski also joins us. He, too, has been an innovator and inventor, and also for the last almost 30 years a teacher at the Kellogg Graduate School up at Northwestern. I'm going to change the question a little bit to you and ask is, what is the biggest challenge facing the American manufacturing sector?
Bruce, I think the biggest challenge facing the U.S. manufacturing sector is that there's been a mindset that's been created over the past several years that really says, if I'm a CEO, well, I just need to outsource all my manufacturing and production overseas. That's the right thing to do. And I think the number one failure for manufacturing today is that we have this wrong thought process that says, well, of course we have to manufacture overseas, as opposed to first and foremost finding an innovative solution and using innovation as a way to say, how can we do it here? How can we find a way to make sure that at least a portion of what we're making today is staying in this country as opposed to going to others? So I think the big problem is that we haven't set it as a priority. We haven't determined that this is something we want to change.
When did we take our eye off the ball? When did we begin to, as Tom just suggested, that maybe there's a better way to do this? Maybe we have given up. Maybe we're giving up a little too early. Chronologically, Dan, when did that start to happen?
To me, the most useful thing is when you look at, you know, sort of corporate America, you need to really divide it into two parts, two different realities. One is a large publicly traded companies that everybody knows about, GM, Motorola, and so on and so forth. It's 13,000 publicly traded companies in this country. They face a certain reality. They could offshore. They could go anywhere in the world to do what they want to. We also have 8 million privately held companies that typically have less than 100 employees, are locally owned. So I agree with Tom. On one hand, the larger companies like Jeffrey Immelt at GE are saying, we got to stop going offshore and come back onshore to start producing things. Small privately held companies throughout the country have over the last 10 or 15 years, if they're still here, they've started to make what we call high value-added products. They've shifted to complex production. The biggest challenge they face, they haven't gone offshore. The biggest challenge they face is they can't find a workforce that has the competencies to do now highly skilled technical work. And to me, that's where our future is. So there's two different realities that we have to address from a standpoint of public policy, of labor policy, of business policy.
Don, you want to tackle that question as well?
Yeah, I can see that. I think that, you know, what's happened, what I've seen in suppliers and people in the marketplace for the last 20 years is the companies that are left are survivors. And those survivors mm-hmm. survived for some reason, particularly they were good at what they did. Oftentimes there's other reasons, like they're in marketplaces that aren't directly threatened by foreign competition or dumping that happens every day. But that workforce is necessary, and the productivity related to that workforce is the competitive advantage you're looking for.
That's right. I mean, we did a study a few years ago that looked at education and training related to manufacturing. In Chicago, the Chicago area, we have 10,500 jobs that have to be filled every year, just because of people, you know, retiring, the baby boom, and so on and so forth. When you add up all the graduates from our various Chicago public schools, city colleges, and you didn't even look at their quality, we only had 5,000 graduates that could fill those positions.
Wow. I mean,
and so, you know, to me, what Dan said is that we have competitive companies, but they can't find the workforce they need. So that's where there's that opportunity.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Talking about jobs, the economy, and the manufacturing sector, and what can be done in America to expand it. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
Nowadays, when I talk with folks, they know GEICO could save them hundreds on their car insurance. But what they want to know is how GEICO does it. Well, I say, we got tons of great discounts, like good driver discounts, multi-car discounts. And they say, there's no secret formula. And I say, nah, it's just what we do. And then sometimes they say, maybe a talking gecko's a secret. Well, I wouldn't know what to say about that.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward, Member FDIC.
From Sacramento, California to Youngstown, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway from coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations and XM and satellite Sirius Radio as well. Nice to have you with us tonight. We're talking about jobs, the economy, specifically the manufacturing sector. And before we go too much further, there's a sort of a political follow-up question that I would like to ask everybody, and then I want to get back into some of the specifics. One of the things that is almost standard in every, certainly U.S. Senate campaign, every 4 years in a presidential campaign, you will have someone stand up in front of a shuttered, whether it's a steel mill or some industry, and say, well, we're going to bring these jobs back. I think Mitt Romney did it during the last campaign. Is that just pure fictitious and phony pandering in your view, Tom, that those industries, remembering the glory days, the good old days, and sort of raising this possibility that those days are coming back, is that pure political BS?
See, Bruce, I don't think we can afford to have it be BS, because here's why. Back in 1969, 26.5% of all of our jobs in this country, 1969, were in the manufacturing sector. Today, it's 10%. We currently have 2.5 million people in the last 2 years that have lost their jobs in the manufacturing sector. These are people who today make up and are part of our 10.2% unemployment rate. I look at that and I say, those 2.5 million people, we have to find a way to bring them back to this manufacturing sector. The question is, how do we do it?
Now, looking at that those figures, where did those jobs go?
They were outsourced, because again, that's,
but are they? But where specifically are they primarily going?
I'd say China.
China.
I don't think China's ever going to let the manufacturing leave their shores. I mean, for a while, you'd see articles about how India and other countries are rising to compete with China. But my experience with China, I've been over there a number of times, and they are just focused as a political economy to keep those jobs, and they'll do anything. And they support their manufacturing tremendously, to the point where the reason those steel mills closed, well, one, I think there was a management issue, but two, the Japanese were making steel and bringing it to Chicago cheaper than we were able to make it here. And that was because of a subsidy created by their governments, that it was a strategic goal of theirs to get into that business and take that market over.
So it's primarily China, but
manufacturing jobs. China. India is more tech jobs and more software-based jobs. But you said manufacturing.
Right.
I would say China, Taiwan, Hong Kong.
Right. And what are we mentioned how this has gone from what 26% to 10% of the jobs. How does that compare with other major industrial nations over the last 25 years?
See,
like Germany and some of the others.
That's what I find Germany in particular to be such a fascinating example. In 2007, Germany exported $1.3 trillion of exports.
They're the largest exporter in the world.
Largest export in the world. Mm-hmm. And what was the number one thing they were exporting? Automobiles. So if Germany can be so successful at manufacturing in their country, in their own country, then I say, why can't the United States of America do the same type of thing? So I think that's an interesting example.
That's a good point to stop on right there.
I think culturally, I mean, I think it's a more complex discussion. You know, I think culturally, I think 30 years ago, we took our eyes off the ball. And we began to, in fact, embrace, I mean, remember the movie Wall Street? Greed is great.
Yeah.
Any good businessman, I mean, look
financial
at what happened in the accounting fields.
Yeah.
That anything was focused on shareholder return, most amount of money in the shortest amount of time was what drove the major institutions of our society. They did away with vocational schools and started talking about college prep. Lane Tech here in Chicago.
Everybody had to go
college,
to school.
Everybody had to go to college to be a doctor and a lawyer. But there became a lack of a focus on the productive economy. That was sustained. The productive economy was sustained in Germany and Denmark and elsewhere while we were speculating across the world at a certain sector. So I think, you know,
how does that? I mean, because we all lived through that change. We heard it in private discussions and professional discussions. How does a discussion grow. I mean, that concept that everybody's got to go, you know, to college as opposed to, you know, I mean, when I went to school, I mean, there was the shop teacher. I mean, there was all kinds of trade related things that were going on, vocational things. There were vocational high schools. How did that mindset get set, and how did it grow like Topsy?
Well, I think it's connected to what I said earlier. I think the larger publicly traded companies, which, by the way, are the only companies you read about in the local newspaper.
Right.
They're in the business section because they're tied to Wall Street. You don't hear about the privately held companies in the business section of the Tribune or whatever. And the big publicly traded companies, not all of them, but a good number of them, began to shift production offshore and help perpetuate the rumor that manufacturing is dead in this economy or in this society, that we're going to go to the new knowledge economy, the new service economy. And it created a mindset.
And they had... political accomplices.
That's right.
Both parties.
And
all
the media,
political persuasion.
And foreign governments. I mean, China subsidized the offshoring tremendously. Companies did not have to pay taxes in China to 2 years after they made money. Then even after then, they were given rewards for it. So we sold it. It was a sold process.
Sure.
It wasn't a competitive process.
One of the things I love about the German manufacturing jobs is that they actually provide employers with incentives to cut their hours as opposed to fire employees. I mean, so there's
When you're unemployed, I think they basically keep the people working and they pay the company the unemployment. They adjust the hours accordingly, but they don't pay people for not working.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a smart
Dan Swinney.
But again, I think despite this larger perception about a certain section of the manufacturing economy, the good news is a very large segment of the privately held companies stayed here and adjusted and shifted to going from simple products that did go offshore to making more complex products. And so I think right now we actually do have a really viable manufacturing base. It's not recognized and understood, and that's why shows like this are so important. So now we need to address our attention to how do we, in fact, make sure this manufacturing, this advanced manufacturing sector that we have, has the talent it needs to thrive, has the public policies it needs to thrive, has rewards new innovators and entrepreneurs that can bring forth new ideas like what Dan has done.
There's an important point here, if I can interrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And companies that were pre-global had a lot of things going for them. They typically owned their equipment. They were well-set companies. They had a lot of equity in the businesses.
Right.
They can survive downturns. New innovative companies are typically bootstrapping it. They're entrepreneurs, and they do not have that access to capital and that ability to transcend it. They're pioneering everything. And now we're expecting these companies to create the new jobs, but they're in the least fit. They have the least ability to sustain that.
Is there any evidence at this moment, although it's still relatively recent, is there any evidence that the stimulus package by the government has any of that money directly or inadvertently ended up in the right pot and is being used for the right purpose, in your view? Professor Kuzmarski.
I think the stimulus package has enabled us to really kind of rethink the importance of jobs in this country and keeping them here. I wish I could tell you that I'm a strong believer that it's already started to work. I can't tell you that I am. And so the question becomes, what else do we need to do? And I'm a strong believer in re-challenging. If we're going to provide government support, let's provide it in terms of encouragement of either tax breaks. Let's provide it in terms of direct jobs for employment. Let's look at it in a way that isn't going to be providing financial institutions and others with a cushion, but rather how do we ensure that it's going to be used directly? And that's what I'm not sure we've done yet.
How do you think it's being used, Dan?
I think it's mixed. I think on one hand, I mean, I think we were faced with a complicated, global economic situation required intervention. I think a lot of the money actually has gone to poor purposes. I mean, it's gone just to short, sort of old approaches to doing things. In fact, now shoring up only Wall Street at a time where, if our focus is only on that, that's a problem. But I don't think it has only been on that. I think some of the stimulus money has gone to teachers. That's very important. I think the president, I think the vice president announced some of the stimulus money went to GM to, in fact, convert one of its companies to making hybrid cars. President Obama in Delaware announced a use of stimulus monies to, in fact, help build the smart grid. And to me, this is the story. And so I think the administration, I think it had to act as it did out of the crisis. I think it's forward thinking. It's looking to new markets. And there's a huge emphasis in the administration on shifting to the markets of renewable energy, wind turbines, of hydroelectric, of solar, And I think we're going to see dollars shifting to that, and that's a very good use of dollars.
Dan Brown?
Well, I'm not going to be redundant. I agree with what the gentleman said, but I don't know that I've seen it in our marketplace in manufacturing, and I'm skeptical that it's going to we're going to see these new market opportunities because our competitors, China and other countries out there who are much more committed than we are to taking over those technologies are going to dominate us just like they have in most other industries. And we are not in a position, I think, to legislate that that solution. We have to fundamentally change the way we do things here. I think Americans have to start thinking about, in context, the survivability of the economy and the sustainability of it when they make purchasing decisions.
Is there a sign that that vocational training is seeping back into the high school curriculum anywhere in the United States, Dan? Swinney?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in one thing the public sector has done, like here in Chicago, Mayor Daley, the city of Chicago has now invested in two cutting edge high schools that I helped play a role in developing.
Right.
One is called Austin Polytech, which is training the next generation of leaders in metalworking. And we're talking about not just a vocational school, by the way. I mean, we have a vocational component of it. We have a new metalworking shop that, by the way, was supported by a local company at the tune of $85,000 to buy new equipment for it. We're also encouraging young people to go into management positions.
Is it happening around the country as well, as far as you know?
There's a focus by the administration on career and technical education. I think in Chicago we have a unique model, but I think it's going to happen in other places around the country.
Okay, we've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Lots of callers on the line. Everybody wants to talk about it, and we'll hear from them when we continue from Chicago.
Okay, that's $11.96. Whoa, what are you doing?
What? I'm giving you cash.
But you're pulling the little guy apart.
Oh, this? No, it's just the money I'm saving with Geico.
But he's the second money with the googly eyes. He has a face.
Yeah, but he's money. And now I'm spending it. Here, take a bill.
Oh, actually, that didn't seem to hurt him at all.
No, we do this all the time.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
From Austin, Texas to Bakersfield, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Got a great panel tonight. Tom Kuzmarski is here. He is a professor at Kellogg Graduate School of Management. That's at Northwestern University. He is a senior, a partner, and president of Kuzmarski & Associates. It is an internationally recognized firm dealing in innovation of new products and services. He's taught almost close to 30 years. He's written 5 books on the subject. Used to be with Booz Allen Hamilton, a graduate of Columbia University. And one of the things that you've been involved with our longtime friend of this program, Dan Miller, is the Chicago Innovation Awards, which, as I understand, are things that happen frequently in other countries of the world. You are the head and sort of leader and the chief cook and bottle washer behind this idea. Tell us what it is in 1,000 words or less.
Bruce, actually, this was the 8th year. We started this 8 years ago because I felt it was so important to put the limelight on all of the innovations that occur in the Midwest and not just have Silicon Valley on the West Coast and Boston for financial services on the East Coast be recognized as innovation hubs. I said, wow, there's so much innovation that occurs in Chicago and the Midwest. Let's make sure we highlight that and show that. So the first year, 8 years ago, we picked 10 winners, and we had 75 people come to the first Chicago Innovation Awards. And this last October, we picked 10 winners again, but we had 800 people come to the Chicago Innovation Awards, and Mayor Daley kicked it all off. And the point is that it's so important to recognize and to let other people celebrate the value of innovation and to see it and to feel it and to watch it, because what that does is it inspires other people to be creative. It really sets a new mindset that says innovation is part of our economy, should be an important part of growing our economy. And last but not least, it's too infrequently we recognize people for what they've done, and this really enables that to happen.
Oh, very good. And one of those such innovators is with us also tonight. He is Dan Brown. He is a designer, an inventor, an entrepreneur, a professor. He attended St. Xavier University. He's been involved with product design consultancy throughout his career. He also teaches at Northwestern University, adjunct professor in the McCormick School of Engineering, and also, as we said, as an engineer. And he is a winner with a product called Bionic Wrench. And this is an award-winning product. Came from your little fertile brain. Tell us about what's so great about the Bionic Wrench.
Well, the Bionic Wrench is unique, and I think it sort of is a tangible example of what you can do when you look at try to look at solving an old problem in a new way, the innovative process. And basically it started out as a case study for my product design firm, as I wanted to actualize or be able to show the concept of creation process. And in doing that, you want to look for a real problem. And as I was looking for problems, one day my son came into my office, and he was changing the blade of a lawnmower, looking for a wrench, and he couldn't find the right size. Grabbed a pliers, and I said, "Stop, don't do that." But he grabbed it and went anyway. And as I sat there steaming, I thought, that would be a great product, something that adjusted like a pliers but grabbed like a wrench. And then the better way to do it is grabbing on the flats versus grabbing on the corners. And that's what the Bionic Wrench does. It's a unique hybrid-type product.
Now, I'm doing this right now. I don't know whether we've got a close-up of this or not. But basically, as you squeeze it, it goes to
The circumference that
you need to do what you need to do.
Right, 14 U.S. metric wrench sizes. So you get that. People grab pliers because they're easy to use and they don't often have the right wrench size. So it gives you the ability to grab that one product and get the job done.
And you've got this great little thing on the back that says Made in USA.
Yeah, that'll be probably on my gravestone too.
Well, let's hope it's made there, but you don't use it very soon. But a couple of follow-up questions. There's a great story of innovation and how one person took an idea. How long did it take you from that very first thought of this concept? Let the audience know, how long does it take to
do something? Well, I didn't do it full time because I was running my business, but I started the story really when my vision of creating this case study happened the day after 9/11. And I was in Las Vegas in 2001. And when 9/11 hit, and everybody's business changed then, I thought, I need to sell harder and have a better way of selling my services, so I needed a case study product. So I started in 2001. 2002, 2003, I worked out and developed the product. 2004, we applied for the patents, and we launched it at the hardware show in 2005. And we won the Popular Mechanics Award for Consumer Product of the Year there, which was really a big boost for us. So basically, a project like that typically is a one-year project full-time, but it was several years because I was doing it and also doing other work.
And the distribution channel for this now is?
Well, traditional retail markets, you'll find it. It's at Sears now and for Christmas, which, stop by Sears and pick a couple up for the stockings. That'd be great.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We've sold in Sam's and Costco, QVC, HSN.
So you're doing all right with distribution.
Yeah, we've been able to distribute it. One of the issues we have is that we're in a marketplace where the benchmark pricing is very low. You can get a 14-piece wrench set for $20 or even less than that in some cases. And we're, American-made product. Our product at Sears that there is at $19.99, which is a fair price, but compared to what a lot of products are coming in from offshore, people are looking at them for $9.99. So we constantly fight that price point that is anchored in the customer's mind.
If you wanted to make this in China or Taiwan, how much cheaper could you make this product?
Oh, it's over 50% cheaper. It's probably would be one-third the cost I pay right now. I'll tell you exactly what it is because I've had Chinese companies call me and offer me the product, my product, and tell me what the price is.
But again, just to go back to sort of consumer demands, and this is something I want to get Dan Swinney to respond to this first if I can. I mean, you have a situation where you're a great entrepreneurial story. You want to keep the jobs here. You could make more money if you shipped it over to someplace else, but you're deciding to keep it here.
Yeah.
And yet you also said in telling your story, well, you know, you're selling wrench sets for this, and there's a lot of cheaper products that may come close to doing this, but people are always looking, generally speaking, for the cheapest or the least expensive thing.
Well, I don't agree with that because we have a tremendous amount of success so far with the wrench. And the thing is getting it in front of the people so they can have the decision. And the process of getting a wrench to market or any other consumer product goes through the gatekeepers of the retailers. And if they don't put it on the shelves, the opportunity for the consumer to make that decision is not there.
And what consumers look for is value, not necessarily price.
Right.
And value is a function of quality divided by price. And so that's what they're looking for.
Let me reintroduce our third guest, and that's Dan Swinney. He is Executive Director of the Center for Labor and Community Research, also the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council. He worked as a machinist for 13 years, a graduate of the University of Wisconsin in history. So he's a man of history and also was once a vice president of Taylor Forge and, again, founded the Center for Labor and Community Research in response to thousands of manufacturing plant closings and jobs that were going else and closing in the Chicagoland area. And he has spent, the last umpteen years of his professional life trying to make things better and creating more jobs. We have a lot of calls on the line, folks. We have really touched a nerve, as you can imagine. Let's go to Spokane, Washington, where Mike is listening to us on KXLY. I should know that by heart by now. Go ahead.
You got it, Bruce. Thank you very much, and hello to your guests, and congratulations on that wrench.
Yeah, it's great. Well,
thank you.
I hope you put a sign to it, Made in America, next to it. You might
You know it does.
Put it on the packaging.
It's on the packaging. Go ahead.
There you go. Well, a couple questions here. Could your guest give examples of smaller or larger companies in America which are successful today? What are they doing or not doing? And are we really learning from successful companies in Europe and Asia?
Let me ask everybody, but Tom, we'll start with you.
Let me give you one example. One of the Chicago Innovation Award winners this year was a company called Suncast. They make this automatic hose reel that winds up your hose based on the water pressure in it. And, they've got one-third of their manufacturing that's done in China. Two-thirds of their manufacturing is done right here in Illinois. And the reason for that was because they felt that they wanted to position this to Americans as an American-made product. On the other hand, they didn't do 100% of it overseas, but they did two-thirds of it here. So, I mean, that's another way to look at this, is that you don't have to have all of your product outsourced overseas. You can do a portion of it here and then a portion of it to blend the cost structure.
Dan Swinney.
Yeah, there's a great company in the Chicago area also called Quality Floatworks. Small manufacturing company, privately held, organized by one of the unions. Has probably about 50 employees. Looking at the future, they sent their staff to visit 80 countries to find out what are the various niche markets. I mean, and they make floats for, what all our listeners would know about a toilet bowl float. But that's the same kind of float can be used in all kinds of, industrial purposes and so on and so forth. They went to some of the developing countries and realized they could be making a float for the process that takes salt out of salt water. And so, first of all, they've been very innovative in looking for new products globally. Second of all, they're a major investor in our local high school that I described before. That's creating the next generation of leaders in manufacturing. They're very active in the Renaissance Council, which is a public-private partnership. So to me, it's a company of the future.
Dan Brown.
One of the companies I'm very impressed with, and I align my view, I think, with, is Herman Miller. And Herman Miller has done a phenomenal job in the office equipment, which has been really struck by
the Grand Rapids machine.
Yeah. And they've leveraged innovation through design. And they design differentiated products that people want. And their sustainability philosophy of long-term thinking, reducing the amount of environmental impact and treating the workers well, I think they just have really done a great job as a corporation to be competitive.
Sam in Chicago, go ahead. You're on the air. You know what? Before we put you on the air, we're going to go to a break, and then we want to come back to you, or else you don't have time to ask the question and get a good response. So stay right where I will come back to you, and also a lot of other callers standing by at 1-800-723-8289. Got a good discussion going tonight. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us.
Inside this truck are some very special batteries, because these batteries are going to the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, where they know that making kids better takes all kinds of technologically advanced equipment, and quite a few Hot Wheels and Barbies and Polly Pockets. So to power all those toys, the people at Duracell pack that truck full of batteries, because they know nothing's better than powering a smile. Duracell, trusted everywhere.
Hey, that stack of money over there with the googly eyes, is that the money you could be saving with Geico?
It's the money I am saving with Geico. He helped me buy this pool table.
Nice. So what else does he do? Can he tell jokes?
Seriously, Kevin, he's a stack of money. He doesn't tell jokes. He just blinks and buys me stuff.
Well, I just thought...
Money can't talk. That's ridiculous. Why do you always take it too far?
Me?
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
From Worcester, Mass. To Saginaw, Michigan, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Sam from Chicago was standing by before we went to the break, so let's go back to him. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Okay.
This is a question I have not been able to figure out. Why is it legal for an American domiciled corporation or a corporation traded on one of the American stock exchanges to stop manufacturing a product in the United States in a factory complying with OSHA and worker safety laws and the minimum wage laws, take the manufacturer of that product to China and manufacture in a factory that does not comply with American minimum wage laws and American worker safety laws, then take that product back to the United States and sell it at the same price to the American people?
Okay,
that's the problem here.
That's a very good question. I think you speak for a lot of people with that question. It seems to me this is one of these things that every couple of years, when there's some political campaign, there's some candidate saying we're going to stop this.
Well, I
want to let Tom Kuzmarski and all of our guests tackle that, but Tom, we'll let you start with that.
I think it's a great question, and here's my answer to it. We have to be able to look at this from two standpoints. One is, what is the quality standard that we're willing to let our consumers be subject to buy? And two, are we going to put some type of actions in place when that quality standard isn't met? And so today, I totally agree. It's very easy to circumvent all of that. And
I'm
yet we have
quality.
To be able
I'm
to put in
minimum
in place.
Wage.
So,
and I'm
go ahead,
OSHA
Sam.
Laws.
What?
I'm talking minimum wage laws, and I'm talking worker safety laws. You have not. I'm waiting for the first documentary to come out, similar to the chicken coop documentaries that show the way chickens are treated in this country.
Yeah.
To show the way workers in China are treated, because I want to know, American people. Are you willing to pay less for products if you know that fingers are being chopped off, that people are being maimed, that they're not the same worker laws, and that basically you're at slave labor wages in China? If you're
But Sam, what I want to go back. You paint a very vivid picture, but and you can stay on the line. But let me go back to your initial question, and that is, what can government do? What can we do to punish companies that make those decisions? All right, let's let Dan respond. Take a breath.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think the laws of this land and many over the last 30 or 40 years have done a lot of crazy things that have been really destructive to our country. I mean, allowed speculation in derivatives and other forms that had no basis in had no real value. I think, but going forward, I think we have to, in fact, look what is a new role for our government to, in fact, improve productive capacity of our country. So I think, you know, rather than just protect, I mean, rather than stand apart from the global economy, I think our government should be rewarding research and development, should be focused on innovation. It should be providing the kind of assistance that Dan Brown talked about that small companies need to get a hold and to expand so we can expand employment.
But the answer to this guy's question is, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, those there that are supposed to be guarding the chicken coop for the American workers, what I'm hearing you say is those companies decided there was a bigger market out there, there was more money to be made out there, and it was more important to make that money than to care about the worker in the United States.
Yeah.
And that gets back to dealing and making the stockholders, you know, the king. And in our economic system, the stockholder is supposed to be king, aren't they?
Bruce,
absolutely.
It's not for that.
Just 1 second. Let Dan respond, and then I'll go back to you, Sam. I promise.
Okay.
You know, in the first instance, you had, you know, in the private sector, you had companies like my company. I used to work for a company called Taylor Forge. They were a healthy company that really took care of their business. They sold out to Gulf and Western and had a business strategy called milking the cash cow. And so you had, in the last 30 years, you had companies who found a way to make a ton of money for shareholders by going anywhere in the world to cut costs. You also had laws in Congress, in our government, that in fact supported that kind of work. That's where I stand with Sam. We need to change that.
Sam, back. Dan's got a comment, and then back to you for the final word, Sam.
I've not heard a real response to this. It should be illegal.
I think I can address it, Sam.
Give him a chance, Dan.
Sam, there's a confusion in the world that corporations, you know, have a social accountability. In fact, corporations were originally founded with social accountability back in the 1800s, and they were restricted in what they could do.
That's what American law
is. Just a minute, Sam. What I'm going to do, okay. Sam, I'm dialing you down. Let's dial Sam down.
So
Sam is asking great questions, but Sam is failing the test of listening. Go ahead.
So corporations have all the rights of an individual in our country, but they have none of the responsibilities. And where they used to have responsibilities where company presidents, et cetera, could be held accountable, there's a corporate veil of accountability in there. So there's no cause and effect of what a corporation can do and what they can be held accountable for. Now, what happened is our trade laws, there's many laws that have been passed and international trade agreements to protect workers' rights and to do the exact thing Sam's talking about. But we have no way of holding China or other countries accountable.
But is there a way? I mean, getting back to the intensity of Sam's call, is there any way to demand, I mean, the people, demanding of our elected officials to sort of address the issue that Sam is talking about.
I think the process of the elected officials, I mean, let's face it, when our officials are lobbied and they get money, they're being paid off. It's bribery, and they tend to follow where the money is. And so the China and a lot of other important, or not important, but a lot of other people involved in this are paying to get the laws not enforced. And in that sense, our capitalism has been corrupted by basically politically influenced special interests, and it destroys our accountability.
We have got to pause at this moment. That was Dan Brown. He's an entrepreneur and inventor. He's going to be back for the next hour. Dan Swinney has also been with us, executive director in the Center for Labor and Community Research. Tom Kuzmarski from Kellogg Graduate School of Management, and also an innovator and creator of the Chicago Innovation Awards. They're all going to be back. We've got a great conversation going. Lots of callers on the line. 1-800-723-8289. If you are listening to this program on radio, keep the calls coming. We've got another full hour of discussion. We're going to be joined by a reporter from the Wall Street Journal in the next hour. And if you're watching this show on television, the next hour is going to be recorded, and you'll be able to see it on television in the next couple of weeks. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
Men, are you urinating more frequently? Do you wake up to urinate? Don't ignore your prostate health. See your doctor for checkups and call for a free bottle of Beta Prostate. Beta Prostate is a natural supplement that helps your body support prostate health. Your prostate affects the quality of your life, including your sleeping habits and intimacy. Beta Prostate has plant sterols shown to support healthy urine flow and healthy sleeping habits. And Beta Prostate is so powerful, you'd have to take 100 saw palmetto capsules to get the same plant sterols found in one Beta Prostate. New customers can get a free bottle of Beta Prostate. You only pay shipping and handling. To get your free bottle of Beta Prostate, call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074. This offer is for one free bottle per household. Call now and try Beta Prostate for free. Call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
Okay, that's $11.96. Whoa, what are you doing?
What? I'm giving you cash.
But you're pulling the little guy apart.
Oh, this? No, it's just the money I'm saving with Geico.
But he's the sack of money with the googly eyes. He has a face.
Yeah, but he's money. And now I'm spending it. Here, take a bill.
Oh, actually, that didn't seem to hurt him at all.
No, we do this all the time.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Announcing the Ally Bank online savings account with the rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at AllyBank.com. Or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward. Member FDIC.
Inside this truck are some very special batteries, because these batteries are going to the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, where they know that making kids better takes all kinds of technologically advanced equipment. And quite a few Hot Wheels and Barbies and Polly Pockets. So to power all those toys, the people at Duracell pack that truck full of batteries. Because they know nothing's better than powering a smile. Duracell. Trusted everywhere.
From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by entrepreneur and manufacturer Dan Brown, Dan Swinney of the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council, innovation expert Tim Kazmarinski, and Tim Appel of the Wall Street Journal. Our program tonight, comedy from our home base at the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, the email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And both the audio and video portion of this discussion and this program will go up on the on our website. It'll be available for many, many months and perhaps years to come. So if you have questions or want to follow up or re-listen to some things that you've already heard, if you're listening to us on the radio show, it will be there on our website, beyondthebeltway.com. We are now joined from his home in Westport, Connecticut, by Tim Appel. He is with the Wall Street Journal. He covers the manufacturing sector. He has spent an awful lot of time visiting and walking the floors of manufacturing plants, both in the United States and Europe. And one of the questions I want to ask you as we begin our second hour of discussion, Tim, is the vast amount of real estate, manufacturing real estate, that exists in this country. How underutilized is that real estate, and how out of focus are many of the companies that own these properties?
Sure, Bruce. I mean, the utilization rate is very, very low right now. This has been the result of this economic downturn. You've had capacity utilization that's dropped below 70% overall, and there's been a lot of discussion about to what degree that will come back. I think companies in general are looking at these questions in terms of not so much what to do with their existing facilities, but where they invest going forward and how they decide where to put their resources in the years to come.
As you look at the big companies that everybody would know, the Fortune 500 companies that, again, are household names, and then you compare the vast majority of companies, much larger, in size that, insofar as actual numbers that people might not know about. Is one of those sectors more innovative about the way they're utilizing their practical resources?
Well, I think there's a dynamic that's at work in a lot of smaller operations where it isn't so much that they have the a lot more resources, but they just, in order to survive, have to be a lot more flexible and quicker. And so I think the pattern you've tended to see over time is that a lot of innovations trickle up essentially from that large number of suppliers. And frankly, as time has gone on, large companies have relied increasingly on their suppliers for not just to make things for them, but to also solve problems for them and come up with new ideas. And I think that's a dynamic that you see in a lot of different industries.
Dan Swinney joins us in Chicago, Executive Director of the Center for Labor and Community Research. This is the first program we have done on this subject in a long, long time, Dan. We're over an hour into the discussion, mm-hmm. where there hasn't been a word uttered about unions. Mm-hmm. You know, there a popular perception is that maybe one of the reasons behind maybe the greed of big business and the people that own some of these businesses is that there has been greed and unrealistic thoughts from the American labor movement. Where would you put the American labor movement in solving the problem? I'm not going to ask you about the blame because there'll be debate about the blame, but what role do they play in solving and making things better?
Yeah, I think actually the American labor movement in the course of the last 20 years has done a lot to try to make it better. I mean, it's been a voice for changes on the plant floor. Recently, a number of the unions across the country have made efforts to create investment funds to start using their pension funds to invest in companies that are innovative, American-owned, and so on and so forth. They've made lots of concessions, in negotiations with management. But in large part, is what I said earlier, I think they've fallen prey to companies that were looking for an excuse to cut costs and to go offshore. But one of the more interesting things in the labor movement, I think it's one of the most significant things in 100 years, actually, and it comes out of the Steelworkers Union, what I used to be part of. Recently, the Steelworkers Union developed a relationship with a group called the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain, which is a network of industrial cooperatives, which are some of the global leaders in major markets around the world. And the steelworkers announced that they're creating this relationship to, in fact, explore a new model of the economy. And so they hope to be involved in buying companies and starting companies in this country, as well as representing the interests of their membership. So I think the labor movement has been doing – and by the way, Rich Trumka, who comes out of an industrial background, is the new president of AFL-CIO, and he's one of the more sophisticated people in terms of investment strategies that combine the interests of business and labor.
Tom Kuzmarski also joins us. He is with the Kellogg Graduate School at Northwestern University. He's been there for almost 30 years, written 5 books on the subject, is an innovator, comes out of the real world of innovation and making things happen. And Tom, your answer to the same question about the role of unions in either creating the problem or helping solve it.
I think this whole subject has to be looked at, Bruce, relative to how can we use innovation to solve all of these problems. So first and foremost, what does that mean? That means if we have grossly underutilized factory and real estate, we have to look at that as a problem that we bring cross-functional people together to try to solve. That doesn't mean we exclude.
What do you mean by cross-functional people?
What that means is that we bring people from the labor union. That means we bring people from manufacturing. We bring people from engineering. We bring people from finance and from marketing and from sales, people that are out with a customer, so that we're not looking at this just from a unit cost standpoint. We're looking at this in a way that says, how can we create products? How can we create new processes that will enable us to bring people back into the plants within this country?
Dan Brown is with us. He also is an innovator and a professor as well at Northwestern in the School of Engineering.
Yep. Well, having brought a product to market in this economy, one that goes right into the heart of imports, there's definitely a role of labor in our future of our survival in business. I'd like to separate the old union paradigm, though, from it, because the context of pre-global and post-global competitiveness, when we were one country competing with ourselves, we had a dynamic where unions and labor competed almost on the same playing field. Now that playing field has changed completely, and we don't have fair market competition. And to have manufacturers in the States be held accountable to work rules and things that were pre-global in this post-global market is not realistic. It doesn't help labor, and it doesn't help business.
Dan Swinney?
Yeah, I think, for example, I think labor is simply changing its perspective based on the realities of the change in the global economy and the needs for this economy. For example, we started a high school. A lot of people said you got to have a charter school. You can't have unions because they're the source of the problem. We went to the teachers' union in Chicago right from the very beginning and found them totally willing to be flexible to make changes once we included them as part of the partnership. The Renaissance Council in Chicago is tied together with labor, working with business, government, and educators, and that's where it has to be.
Tim Appel, we're going to break for a commercial, but when we come back, I want to get your take on the role of unions as it relates to the way you're covering the story. And we will do that. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. We'll also bring those conversations into our topic here in Chicago.
It's quite a proposition when you think about it. You contact GEICO and you could save hundreds on your car insurance. 15 minutes, simple as that. Something they've been doing for over 70 years. You want car insurance and you want extra money in your wallet, done and done. Now, not only do you have some nice car insurance, you've got plenty of money to spend on some tasty biscuits. Or flowers for your mum. Or whatever it is you fancy.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to also ask a question now of Tim Appel, who's with the Wall Street Journal, who joins us, who covers manufacturing, the manufacturing sector. One huge story or battle cry over the last 15 years, Tim, was Made in America. Look for the Made in America label. And, you know, Walmart, as I recall, I mean, that whole cry sort of launched that company as the behemoth that it has become. But as you look at the world of manufacturing, how much of that Made in America battle cry, how much of the – is there much political value in that term anymore?
Well, it's a good question, because I think one of the things that I've noticed lately, and I think, as you said, it's always been a sort of a subtext, but it's become very prominent. I've noticed like ads for companies where they actually run their television ads, where they focus on, there's a company, I believe in Indiana, that makes blood monitoring devices. I believe it's Indiana. Anyway, they make blood monitoring devices, and the whole ad campaign is based on the idea that they're made here. And I think certainly a lot more companies are looking at that to figure out to what degree it carries extra value. I think frankly, it probably varies a lot from one industry to another. There are some industries where the perception of things made domestically still are held very high. Other items, I think there's been less, as you know, you were mentioning Walmart. I mean, a lot of the things you see in Walmart, there aren't U.S. alternatives. It's not as though there's a competition in the marketplace for the idea of who makes the best sandals in the world, because the U.S. has largely gotten out of shoes and a lot of those everyday items that people buy. Yet at the same time, they'll drive out of the Walmart parking lot and they'll see, you know, Caterpillar equipment, you know, building an overpass on the highway, and people all over the world buy Caterpillar equipment. It's perceived as a premier brand, and so I think it really is a dichotomy.
Dan Swinney, your response. I want to get everybody's response to the whole Buy American. My recollection was that was something from the late 70s, where it really grew in early 80s, was it not?
But I agree with Tim. Actually, I think there's a revival of that concern, because people have seen the consequence of offshoring. and seeing what has driven it. I actually had a question for Tim related to that.
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, recently Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, said we need to double manufacturing employment in this country by bringing work back here. And I think he opened a new plant in Schenectady to, you know, sort of retrofit diesel engines to make them hybrid engines. GE has gotten deeply involved in renewable energy. And I was going to ask Tim if Jeff Immelt is an exception or does he represent a trend in some of the larger publicly traded companies to take this issue seriously?
I think at this point, frankly, just looking at on the face of it, he's the exception, because mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons his comments caused such a stir, because it is so out of the mainstream of thought of large global corporations. I mean, all of the large corporations that I talk to that are conscious of the value of producing where they sell, and therefore they value, on the most part, having a productive ability in the U.S. But the idea of actually targeting, especially a target like that, which is extremely ambitious. I mean, I thought to target the number of jobs is particularly interesting, because we've seen in manufacturing led by companies like GE just this amazing productivity drive that has basically allowed manufacturers to produce so much more with fewer people. So the idea that you would double the workforce is actually implying an output production that's even, you know, on a far larger scale. So I do think that's sort of the exception as opposed to representing a trend.
Tom Kuzmarski of Kellogg Graduate School has a comment as well, I think, on the Made America
challenge. I think we are ready in this country for that type of campaign. Now, I just got to tell the story because I absolutely love it. There's a guy by the name of Ed Lowe. He invented kitty litter back in the 1940s. Kitty litter and Tidy Cat 3. And I was on his board in the 70s and the 80s when he was pounding his fist on the table in terms of, we've got to make this in America. And, of course, he did. Now, it's one thing to tell the consumer that your kitty litter has been made in America. It's a very different thing to be able to talk about products and services that you interact with every day that are meaningful to you, and the compelling story that this is made by Americans, I think, today could have great merit for a company, and even more so for a competitor. So the competitor begins to talk about the fact that their products are made in the United States of America as opposed to their competition that isn't.
But, Dan, you said a little while ago when you were talking about getting your wrench and where the key decisions have been made in products that you've brought to market, primarily maybe in the hard goods or the hardware area. You say you've got to, obviously, as people know, you've got to sell the buyer for Walmart or Sears before you get anyone else.
Exactly.
And my question to this is, when you're at that level, I mean, this is the make or break interview when you're sitting down with those people, because they're going to say, you know what, we're going to put you in 500 stores or we're not going to put you anywhere. When you're having discussions with those people, do they care that Americans are making those things, or are they only concerned about what is the cost going to be to, whether it's Sears or Kmart or Walmart? And you know what? You have a great product, but we're gonna take this other product because, you know, it saves us, the corporation, saves us, you know, 35, 40 cents.
Yeah, we've had in the States a change in the mass market from, you know, market and merchandisers to basically, you know, everyday low price. The buyers I talk to all personally, I think, believe in that. But in the political aspects of the corporation and reducing their risk, it's all on price. So I'm constantly being told, go to China. And we've had been not in a lot of areas because of it. I'm not a protectionist. I don't believe everything needs to be made in the States.
Let us go to Sylvia and listening to us in Winnebago, Illinois. Good evening. You're on the air with our guests talking coast to coast. Go ahead.
Well, what's the value of a Made in America label if the employees are illegal aliens? It's meaningless. When are they going to start, you know, using E-Verify?
Okay, let's let our manufacturer talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, the issue of illegal aliens, the way I normally answer this is I don't support illegal aliens, When I chose a manufacturer to make my wrench in the States, I visited the plants and we made sure that workers were treated right. Because
Thank you very much.
I don't believe it's right just to import labor abuses. But we don't really have an illegal alien problem per se. We have a jobs problem. Those aliens that used to be the workers that came in and took jobs that a lot of Americans didn't take and drive our economy, the jobs just aren't there anymore. My grandparent was an alien that came from Ireland and, you know, looked for jobs, and most of us came out of that generation. But now what's happened is there's so few jobs that the aliens or the people that are coming and taking those jobs, people are recognizing that they're not working, and that creates that problem. But I think projecting onto any individual who wants to work, you know, something that they're doing it wrong, I don't think that's a proper focus. I don't think they should be here illegally.
But they're doing it wrong if they violated the law. I mean, I don't know. Did your grandparents do it legally or illegally?
Well, back then, I mean, aliens were an asset. They were bringing them over by the boatload because they needed people to dig the ditches.
In Las Vegas, they say they're an asset right now. They couldn't run the city without illegal immigrants.
And I think that there's a large context to that because there's always going to be that low end of the worker marketplace. But,
yeah, they claim that they can't milk cows without illegal aliens now.
And you'd have
no milk if there weren't illegal aliens.
And it possibly is true because a lot of companies are doing everything possible to remain competitive and to stay in the States. But I personally don't like to shine a light on an individual who wants to work. I know I feel your pain, and I think companies need to follow and abide by the laws. But our biggest laws that are being broken are the trade laws that are not being the fair trade issues that are not being accountability is not being held right now. The situation where China's manipulating its currency and doing everything possible to take advantage in the marketplace, that's destroying far more jobs than illegal aliens working for, you know, probably under minimum wage or cash or whatever.
Do you agree with that point, Dan Swinney?
Well, the point I want to make, I think this Buy American, it really has two sides to it. I think if it's we're going to buy American, it is because American products are the best, the most innovative, the most reliable, and so on and so forth, not just because they're made by a certain group of people or because it's made in America. So I think, I mean, the future of our country is looking forward to how we're going to, in fact, be the most
competitive. No, but what Sylvia's worried about is mm-hmm. our products that say made in America being made by illegal immigrants.
But that's not where the jobs have gone.
Well, first of all, I think we have residents, whether legal or illegal, that are hardworking people that contribute to our society and should be part of our society. I think how we solve the legal issues of immigrant reform is a complex issue. But we have millions of people of various backgrounds who have various forms of status who contribute to our country, and we should recognize that and value those people.
Tom, your response.
I share what Dan just said. I mean, we have to be able to look at this in a way that's going to address illegal reform issues. And I think it's
demonizing a group is not the answer.
Right. Tim, a question to you. In the manufacturers that you talk about, are they concerned about illegal immigration? What role do they see the illegal immigrants playing in the success of their companies?
Well, I guess it's so intermeshed into the economy at this point. I don't know that they view it as an issue in that sense. I mean, I think that, you know, I was out in California recently, and there's a clothing manufacturer there which has sort of publicly fought this issue, and they were cracked down on, and I think some enormous percentage of their workforce disappeared overnight. Not disappeared in the sense of disappearing into the woodwork, but we're actually deported.
On that note, Tim, on that note, I know that you've got to run and we've got a break coming up. But Tim Appel, manufacturing reporter for the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us from your home in Westport, Connecticut tonight. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly.
Men, are you urinating more frequently? Do you wake up to urinate? Don't ignore your prostate health. See your doctor for checkups and call for a free bottle of Beta Prostate. Beta Prostate is a natural supplement that helps your body support prostate health. Your prostate affects the quality of your life, including your sleeping habits and intimacy. Beta Prostate has plant sterols shown to support healthy urine flow and healthy sleeping habits. And Beta Prostate is so powerful, you'd have to take 100 saw palmetto capsules to get the same plant sterols found in one Beta Prostate. New customers can get a free bottle of Beta Prostate. You only pay shipping and handling. To get your free bottle of Beta Prostate, call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074. This offer is for one free bottle per household. Call now and try Beta Prostate for free. Call 1-800-922-4074. That's 1-800-922-4074.
A reminder that on the 5th of December, Bill Jackson, one of the great children's television icons in Chicago history, will be coming to the Lake Theater in Oak Park. If you would like to have tickets, they are available at museum.tv, or you can call 312-822-0512 at 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday, December 5th. Bill is coming back with BJ. It'll be BJ and Dirty Dragon and all the characters that many of you grew up listening to. It'll be his final performance. He's coming back to Chicago to make one final performance. So it's not just going to be a lot of talk. It's going to be a lot of fun. And again, if you'd like to buy tickets, they're available at www.museum.tv. Our in-studio guest this evening, Tom Kuzmarski, is here. He is a senior partner and president of Kuzmarski & Associates. That's a nationally recognized expert firm in the innovation of new products and services. He has spent over close to 30 years at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management teaching on issues of innovation. He is founder, along with our good friend Dan Miller, of the Chicago Innovation Awards, and he's written 5 books on the subject of innovation and the business community, and former principal at Booz Allen as a consultant. And again, Tom, it's nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway this evening. Dan Brown also joins us. Forgive me for calling you. One of my good friends from college was Don Brown, so I know I've said that a couple of times tonight. Dan Brown joins us this evening. He is a designer, an inventor, an entrepreneur, a professor. He teaches at Northwestern University's, where he's an adjunct professor at the McCormick School of Engineering, and also a graduate of St. Xavier University. But he is an innovator. He's an entrepreneur. He puts his money where his mouth is, and he's created this new product called the Bionic Wrench. The Bionic Wrench, and this is what he's sent to market. And again, our congratulations, and also a former winner of the Innovation Awards. Yes. Dan Swinney joins us. You've heard him on this program a number of times over the last several years. He is executive director of the Center for Labor and Community Research, also with the Chicago Manufacturing Renaissance Council. Again, 13 years as a union machinist, graduate from the University of Wisconsin, where he was a history major, and now he's helping make history and trying to save jobs, not only in Chicago, but coming up with some really innovative things. And I think that so much time in media, of course, is spent on the bad things and the horrible things that are going on in society, and in many cases, the horrible things that businesses are up to. Tonight, we're giving a little different perspective on how there's a lot of good things that are going on there. But as I think all of our guests have said in a different way, there's a lot of this that's really screwed up and really needs to be addressed. And Dan, you wanted to elaborate on a point that was made in the previous segment about illegal immigration, I believe, and made in America.
Yeah, that question comes up quite a bit, where people start blaming new residents, whether they're legal or illegal, in this country, as taking away American jobs. The problem is not the residents who come in here looking for work, because that's what they're coming here for. The problem is you have what I call low-road employers that are willing to use immigrants who may come from rural areas, may not have language mastery or whatever, as a way to really lower wages, worsen working conditions, and to take full-time jobs with benefits and convert them to part-time jobs out of a day labor agency. So my view is the anger should not be focused on new immigrants. It should be focused on people who are so focused on a short term, they're willing to do anything,
but
no
again,
matter how destructive it is.
The people that you say are the culprits here, mm-hmm. then, are, let me switch over to Dan Brown. The culprits are those corporations. They can be big corporations, or they can be small corporations that nobody knows about. So someone who comes out of that sector,
I think a lot of big
what
companies,
about what he just yeah. said?
I think a lot of big companies are aware of it, and they practice policies to avoid it. They'll typically will then outsource to a local company who then as a third party. So they have a clean, a disconnect between their accountability. But the reality is we have to start holding corporations accountable for all types of things, from our financial markets to environmental responsibility. And we have laws on the books oftentimes.
So we just don't
have the accountability.
The practical case here, let's say you're a small manufacturer. You've got, let's say, 75, 80, 85 employees, okay? You're trying to make it. You're trying to return, an investment either to your investors or to you, or to, plan for your grandson's future. Whatever it is, this has been your blood, sweat, and tears is in creating a company. And he will say, if the INS shows up, he'll say, well, you know what? If I'm paying, you know, Jose, you know, $15 an hour or $8 an hour, I can survive. If I've got to pay, you know, Charlie, who's, you know, got more experience, if I've got to pay him twice as much, I can't survive.
You know,
so what does is he a good guy or a bad guy?
I get in the plants all the time, and I'll tell you, undocumented workers and documented workers, there's plenty of legal people who have immigrated that are working at that low wage scale, and they. Companies should not hire undocumented workers because it creates a whole other stream of issues with immigration or illegal immigration. But I don't think it comes down to that. There's plenty of other people willing to work for the low price.
But are they doing it for the reason that Dan Swinney just said? We can bring them in. Let's send a signal to everyone who's on the factory floor. You know what, guys? We got people here working for cheap. And you know what? If you're not ready to work for cheap, you're going to go.
I think it may have happened early on, but I don't think it happens that way now. I think there's so much supply of labor that type of metaphorical stick doesn't work.
Do you agree with that, Tom?
In fact, 2.5 million people right now would turn to that. I think it's a matter – look, I think it's a matter that we've got to be able to say, of course if we're looking at $15 an hour versus $30 an hour, right, everybody's going to go towards the $15 an hour. At some point, we have to say no. And so
Who says no?
Both the manufacturer has to say no, has to have the guts to say no. But I contend that we need to provide companies with tax incentives and other forms of recognition that will get them and encourage them to make that decision.
Such as?
Absolutely. There should be tax incentives so that my company will pay lower taxes this year if I'm actually both hiring people and manufacturing in the U.S. and I'm also building plants and putting capital into those plants. That's going to provide me with a substantial tax advantage.
Can I add one?
Sure.
Because as part of that business tax that you're filing, you are affirming that all of your employees have been checked.
Uh-huh.
They are all
sure
legal citizens. And if you do that, if you know, once mm-hmm. upon a time you were supposed to be good for nothing, pardon the expression.
Mm-hmm.
But now there may be an incentive to being good.
Right.
And build it into the tax code.
Right.
Do you agree with that, Dan? Is that a way to do it?
Well, I think that's part of the solution. I think so. That tax code and that tax relief should include investing in worker training. So what that small manufacturer should be saying is he should not be worried about cutting wages. He should be figuring out how to get the value that justifies a higher wage for his workforce. So he should be incentivized to start doing incumbent worker training so they can move upstream on the value-added chain. So that's his approach, as opposed to looking for ways he can undercut the wages of his existing workforce.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Jim listening to us in South Elgin on WLS and Coast to Coast. Go ahead,
Good
Jim.
Good evening. A lot of the problems we have is I blame the government. You can see it going on out today with the health care debate where they totally ignore tort reform. The environmental laws, the union thuggery that goes on, and a lot of the things that go on. And there was a good example recently. I read a story about a company called Columbia Falls Aluminum Company out in Montana. And they are closing their doors because they are forced via environmental edicts and all this stuff to buy more expensive electricity, even though in a free market they could buy for a lot less money and keep their doors open, but they have to pay too much, so it's not competitive. And so, of course, this company closed. And at one time, they had something like 1,600 or 2,000 employees, and that's all gone now.
All right, let me ask our manufacturer here. Dan, are there too many government – is there too much government red tape?
Well, I mean that's a big. I think in general, yes. I'm going to always say yes. But
we could do a 3-hour show.
Right.
Just touch it.
I think that. Well, one, I would like to go back a second because I wanted to make sure. I don't think that the issue is the ethnicity or the culture of any worker and what they're willing to work for. I think the problem is that we've gone into this crony capitalistic model of opportunistic capitalism where. We're arbitraging the financial aspects of a business versus the sustainability of products and markets and long-term business thinking. And it's really an issue that has to do with a social and economic issue from a sustainability standpoint. Now, to talk about the aluminum company, aluminum takes a lot of electricity when you make that. And I don't know what the specifics are, but that company is competing with aluminum coming in offshore when oftentimes those companies making that aluminum are getting the electricity virtually for free because their governments want to support that industry. That's dumping.
We have
laws against that dumping, but we do not enforce them.
You also talked a little while ago about the trade laws. Tom, I want to just turn back to you to sort of move this part of the discussion along. Is the strong enforcement of the trade laws, which Dan had suggested. Can you give an example to the audience about sort of an egregious abuse of trade laws that the audience can maybe comprehend?
Well, I think whenever you look at a country who is manufacturing with people and processes that are first and foremost not up to the human standards of the way we would do it, that in and of itself provides a massive fault to this whole approach. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on in China, and so we have to be able to look at that in a way that's gonna. Address it.
I want to get everybody else's response to that same question. Also take more calls, 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. One more segment. We've been rolling along with lots of calls and great discussion tonight on the issue that probably is the most important issue in this country, the economy, jobs. Specifically tonight, we're focusing on the blue-collar manufacturing jobs, but a lot of other people are hurting too, and we'll talk more about that when we continue.
Recalculating route.
What's up with this GPS?
You need to finish your holiday shopping.
Right. I doubt Michelle would want another spice rack.
Chase Freedom gives you 3% cash back.
I can get Michelle that new camera, plus 3% cash back for me. Hey, how do you know so much?
My brother's a Chase ATM.
Chase Freedom gives you 3% cash back at computer and electronic stores, discount stores, and bookstores. Just sign up at chase.com/freedom. Chase, what matters.
Chase cards issued by Chase Bank USA NA and are subject to credit approval. Restrictions apply.
Okay, that's $11.96. Whoa, what are you doing?
What? I'm giving you cash.
But you're pulling the little guy apart.
Oh, this? No, it's just the money I'm saving with Geico.
But he's the sack of money with the googly eyes. He has a face.
Yeah, but he's money. And now I'm spending it. Here, take a bill.
Oh, actually, that didn't seem to hurt him at all.
No, we do this all the time.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago for our final segment. And Dan Brown, you wanted to add something to what Tom was saying before the break.
Well, we were talking about, opportunistic behavior and what happens in the trade. And two things came to mind. One was the melamine that was in the dog food where the product was being added to pass a test. It came in and was killing a lot of dogs. And we have, regulations and rules in place, but if you don't enforce them, it's really not going to make a difference. And Tom brought up a great
And lead in the toys.
Right, lead in the toys. Mm-hmm. And Tom talked about the drywall situation that's really a major issue down in the southeastern part of the country. After one of the recent hurricanes in New Orleans and then another one in Florida, we ran out of drywall here in the country. We went offshore to get that. And Tom will tell you the story. It's a horrendous story.
What happened, Tom?
Well, the drywall that we now have that's being imported from China is causing people, because it's accumulating mold, and it's causing people allergies and all sorts of illnesses. And just imagine the drywall that's in people's homes down there. The quality has been so poor that it's going to have to be ripped out.
Products that should not be in normal drywall. The humidity in that southeastern part of the country mm-hmm. created nauseous gases. They were off-gassing, and people are having horrendous. They're ripping drywall.
The drywall that's made in the United States, this is not, we're not on
my. No.
USG is the good stuff that's made in the United States.
Yes. This is China.
So if you're building a house.
Yep.
This was one particular plant in China, and they're not bringing it in now anymore, obviously. Mm-hmm. But when we ran out of it.
But who made that decision?
Well, the market did. We ran out of drywall due to the situation and supply demand situation.
Is this hurricane Katrina or I mean, is
after
is somebody...
Katrina, there was a couple hurricanes in Florida that once Katrina rebuilding was going on, it sucked up a lot of drywall.
But my question, when you talk about the decision, because I believe that behind every decision, there's a name of a person. There's somebody that says, okay, we're going to take this over this. Is that person, and I don't know whether we know this for this particular point, but is that a person who is that a government employee that made that decision?
No, I would say that was somebody
trying to get it on the cheap.
Or a number of people in the distribution channel of drywall wanted to get it, and they decided to bring it in from China, and they didn't test it. And they didn't look at it. They just thought all drywall is generic, and they pushed it into the system. And then the decision to put the material in the drywall was what happens oftentimes when you squeeze somebody's so tight. And I've been to China. I love the Chinese. They're great people. I mean, I have nothing against them.
But
they'll take every shortcut possible because we squeeze them so tight on price that just with the melanin, the drywall, or any number of things, you got to watch what comes over because they're trying to squeeze pennies out of that dollar. They're living off a very low margin, and they'll do anything possible to make a little money.
But again, the person who accepted it, that put it into how many homes do we know?
They only found that person is a supply chain for drywall, and there's multiple people in there. Though I'm not going to name names of companies, but there was certain companies that imported container loads of drywall and put it through their distribution system. Nobody consciously says it. No one ever does, but they also don't think of the implications of what the potential problems,
which could be serious long-term health issues, which gets into some environmental issues that I know are near and dear to your heart, Dan Swain.
Well, it's a good segue. I mean, what you needed there, if you didn't have it, it was appropriate regulation to prevent this kind of hazardous material being used in our homes. And back to the earlier point about the environment, and we need to, in fact, protect our environment. And I think we're all well aware of the cost of fossil fuels on contaminating our environment to the point that we're all at risk. But what environmental regulation needs to be combined with opportunity. And when you're talking about electricity, as earlier caller talked about, there's an enormous opportunity for us to shift towards renewable sources like wind and water. In fact, you have 85,000 jobs now focused on wind turbines. That's going to double in the next 5 years if this country competes to be part of that supply chain. So in my view, we need good regulation, but we also then need to look at new markets that improve the environment.
But how do you compete? How do you make wind turbines cheaper than a foreign country that's going to subsidize and dump them into our marketplace?
Well, in the city of Chicago, we have this administration, Mayor Daley, his departments are working with us to, in fact, help companies be introduced to the OEMs that are coming from Europe to pre-qualify them so they can make the gears, the bearings, the generators, and the valves that go into those, and provide an educational system like Austin Polytech to provide the employees to do that work.
I agree.
We can compete.
But the major thing that drives me nuts, and I'm an innovator and I love innovation, but it's been used so much that it becomes politically expedient to gravitate to innovation. But the contract with innovation is there's got to be that risk-reward. You have to have the reward.
Right.
And if companies cannot invest and see that light at the end of the tunnel, they're going to shortcut and they're going to offshore. They're going to do whatever they can to hedge their bets. And that's the type of scenario we have.
Well, and we've also today more than 50% of all R&D of U.S. companies are outsourced overseas. And so even the source of innovation in terms of R&D dollars and investments aren't –
And it's only going to
residing
get worse.
Here.
I mean, we can sit here 5 years from now, and it's probably going to be half of that because
tell us just on the whole issue of brain drain. Tell us about the story that you referenced earlier in one of our breaks about the students that you teach at Northwestern, foreign students coming here. Talk about the enthusiasm they have.
I got to tell you,
I'm
often impressed. I mean, I'm very fortunate to be able to teach. I think that's a privilege in life, and it makes me a better person. But I was just over this weekend in an innovation type competition for undergraduates at Northwestern, and what continually shocks me is how motivated foreign students are to learn what needs to be done and to learn the advantages of differentiation and creating value, even much more than American students. And I don't want to demonize a class, and I hate saying one class over another. But when we have I had a lecture and about this actual topic, and these students are so motivated, it scares me because if they go back to their countries. The nail's in the coffin for us.
Dan Brown has been with us. He is an innovator, a terrific guy, entrepreneur, also teaches at up at the Northwestern in the School of Engineering, and again, the president of Loggerhead Tools. Thanks very much for being with us. Also, Tom Kaczmarski is here for almost 30 years now, a teacher at the Kellogg Graduate School of Innovator in his own mind, and the creator of the Innovation Awards here in Chicago. And Dan Swinney, executive director of the Center for Labor and Community Research. It's been a great show tonight. We're going to invite this panel back again. We had lots of great calls and really terrific conversation about a very, very urgent issue of national significance and national security, if you will. Tom Veracruz and Ben Stewart helped make this program possible. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Individual results may vary. Program not available in all states. See contract for complete terms.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there is powerful information you need to know about the government's bailout of credit card companies. If you have more than $10,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe with monthly payments you can afford. Credit card companies have been given billions and need to clean their books once and for all. And that's great news for you. We're Credit Answers, and we'd like to offer you free information that will show you how to settle your credit card debt with payment plans customized for you. It's yours free by calling 1-800-209-9451. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and learn how we have saved our clients millions. Live better, debt-free. For free information on how to settle your credit card debt in a government bailout era, call 1-800-209-9451. That's 1-800-209-9451. 1-800-209-9451.
Hey, that stack of money over there with the googly eyes, is that the money you could be saving with Geico?
It's the money I am saving with Geico. He helped me buy this pool table.
Nice. So what else does he do? Can he tell jokes?
Seriously, Kevin, he's a stack of money. He doesn't tell jokes. He just blinks and buys me stuff.
Well, I just thought...
Money can't talk. That's ridiculous. Why do you always take it too far?
Me?
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
Inside this truck are some very special batteries, because these batteries are going to the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, where they know that making kids better takes all kinds of technologically advanced equipment and quite a few Hot Wheels and Barbies and Polly Pockets. So to power all those toys, the people at Duracell pack that truck full of batteries, because they know nothing's better than powering a smile. Duracell, trusted everywhere.
Announcing the Ally Bank Online Savings Account with a rate that's among the most competitive in the country. If you're waiting for the terms and conditions, forget about it. It really is that straightforward. Nothing confusing, hazy, ambiguous, dubious, or dodgy. No double dealing, double speak, or double meanings. Just an online savings account with a great rate. Compare rates for yourself at allybank.com or call Ally at 877-247-ALLY. Ally, straightforward, member FDIC.